Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Well, good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover on Colfax. Thanks so much for coming. Thank you so much for supporting our author events and for supporting independent bookstores. We really appreciate that. It is a great pleasure for me to get to introduce Anne Fortier because Juliet, I think, is my favorite book for quite a while now. I got the galley of it some time ago, and I knew I was doing the signing, and Charles told me it was our autographed book club selection, and so I dove in, got sucked in, and I work at a library by day, so I started reading, and 2 o'clock in the morning came around, and Lisa, the author escort tonight, reminded me that, because I had told Charles I had to get up early the next morning to finish reading before I could go to work, and so, I mean, I would have had to, like, be late to work because it was such a good book. So I'm not going to dwell on the plot, telling you everything about that. I want to give Anne the time. But basically, this is her debut novel, and it kind of talks about Romeo and Juliet and how that tale began, and it links it to the current time, to a Julie who is related to Juliet. And you find out how throughout the story because it goes back and forth in time. And it's set in Siena. And if any one of you have ever been to Siena, this book will help you picture every street. I've only been there once, and it took me right there to the Palio, to everything. She did an excellent job. I can't say enough good things about this book. I think it'll be an excellent book club book. I think there's a lot to discuss. And Anne has a very interesting background, and I want her to be able to talk about that with you and how this book came into being. But she grew up in Denmark and immigrated to the U.S. in 2002 to work on a film. And she has a PhD in the history of ideas from Aarhus University in Denmark. And she and her husband currently divide their time between North America and Europe. And this story, Juliet, was inspired by her mother, who always considered Verona her true home until she saw and went to Siena. And Anne is here tonight with her family. So please welcome Anne Fortier.
Thanks so much, Lisa. I'm so happy to hear about this staying up late to read, because that's how I'm always with books. I just can't put them down. And it's great to be here. Thanks, you guys, for coming here and supporting your local independent bookstore. So important. No, it's a real treat to be here, and I don't know if you realize this is a really special night for me because today is the day that the book finally came out in the U.S., right? And, I mean, the book has been underway for 2 years, pretty much 2 years, minus 1 month, because I sold it in September 2008. So it's taken them 2 years, and it would have taken them a year and a half, but then I got pregnant. And so and my little baby is in the back there with my husband. She's sleeping actually right now. But the book should have been out in February in this year, but then was postponed because Isabel came in February instead. So here we are, and I can't tell you how much I've looked forward to this, and it's just fun to be in Denver. I've never actually been to Denver before, so it's a real treat to be here. It's such a beautiful place and such a vibrant downtown. It's a real treat. I mean, we lived in Indianapolis for a while, and it's a totally different thing. All right. Anyway, so Juliet, you know, Lisa already did a pretty good job in talking about how this is a story about a young woman from the U.S. who discovers that she might be descended from Shakespeare's Juliet, and she goes to Siena looking for her roots, looking to find out what happened to her parents, because there's some big weird thing going on in the family. Nobody's ever really talking about what happened to her parents, and of course discovers that further and further back in history, there are some interesting links there between her and Romeo and Juliet, the original ones. And then at some point the story starts switching back and forth between the present day Siena and then Siena in the 1340, which is sort of the late Middle Ages and just before the bubonic plague, which happened, you know, wiped out pretty much half of Europe's population in 1347 and 48. And of course it was too tempting to work in that area there. But I want to tell you a little bit about how the idea came for the book, because I think that a lot of people assume that, you know, this is just another one trying to spin off a story of some famous, you know, person. You know, why do I even bother? I don't even like you, Romeo and Juliet. You know, a lot of people said, I don't even like Romeo and Juliet. Why should I read this book? Like, you know, I actually, honestly, quite frankly, didn't like Romeo and Juliet either when I read it the first time, because I think it's, first of all, I like happy endings, okay? So it's not really my story. And then, you know, there's a whole other set of issues for a modern woman reading about this 13-year-old girl falling for this guy at a ball, and it's tricky. But this is what happened. I actually went to Siena with my mother, and because Mom was in love with Siena at the time. I mean, we'd had a thing with Verona before, always had a thing with Juliet, with Romeo and Juliet, because Mom used to live in Verona. And then suddenly we're in Siena, and I think to myself, this is a beautiful place. I want to set a story here. Now, I walked around, you know, and how many have been to Siena? Oh, that's quite a few. Okay. So you know what I mean when I say you walk around there and you just think, wow, you know, and you start soaking up the history, you start looking around, and I started taking notes. You know, notes, you know, family, bad family feud. I still have my notes. Bad family feud. The Salimbenis and the Ptolemies. And I was walking around, planning, what could my story be? And then, lo and behold, that night in the hotel room, my mother suddenly looks up from her guidebook she's reading and says, do you realize the first version of the Romeo and Juliet story was actually set here in Siena? I said, really? Get out of here. You know, I'd seen Shakespeare in Love. You've seen Shakespeare in Love, right? Yeah. Love it. Gorgeous film. But it sounds like Shakespeare invented the story, right? No, you know, Shakespeare actually took the story from another writer who'd taken the story from another writer. And there's a long history of that story. And it all goes back to 1476, when this Italian author wrote the story for the first time and set it in Siena. And I thought, wow, you know, I'm gonna try to take this famous story and take it back to its origins and try to imagine what it could have been like. You know, how, you know, this the gritty story of what it could have been like if it had in fact happened in Siena. And so that's why you have a lot of Siena elements in the story. Right? That's why you have the Palio in there, right? You know, I don't think I'm giving too much away by saying that Romeo has to ride in the ancient Palio, right? So, you know, what I'm trying to work with Shakespeare, the elements of Shakespeare's famous tragedy, all these different elements with the sleeping potion, the you know, Paris, she is supposed to marry this unwanted husband, you know, the handsome Paris, and the death of her cousin, all those elements I'm trying to use in the original story of Romeo and Juliet in 1340. And of course the plague also has something also plays in there. So it's a mixed, you might say it's a mixed, the inspiration for this is a mix of Siena, Siena history, Siena present, and of course, you know, the literature with Shakespeare as the most famous writer in the tradition of the Romeo and Juliet story. And then, of course, you know, with Siena, once you start digging in Siena, you know, you find out it's a very interesting place. You know, all sorts of secrets, and I don't want to give too much away because it is a treasure hunt, and I don't want to tell you what the treasure is and where it is, because that's part of the fun of this story. So that's part of how I came to the story. And one thing that a lot of people ask me is, you know, they say, you know, when I read the 1340 story and then I read the present day chapters, I don't believe it's the same person who wrote those. Right. And how did you do that? How did you sort of switch back and forth between those chapters? And you just get it carried away. I just got carried away with, you know, the inspiration from Shakespeare. And it's not that I'm trying to be Shakespeare. Don't worry, because nobody should try to be Shakespeare. But, you know, you get inspired by another. Once you've done a lot of research on this period, which I did with my mother's help, a lot of research of what life was really like back then. And you have all that framework ready, and you start giving life to the characters, they just took off. I mean, suddenly they just started living, these medieval characters. And I hadn't even originally planned to write out that story. I had actually planned just to write out the present day story first and then insert sort of letters and, you know, short stories that the present day character would find. And she would then slowly piece together the ancient story. As it turned out, these characters demanded to be, you know, to have a life of their own. And so they have a huge life of their own in the story. And I got sort of carried away by it that, you know, sometimes I would just be sort of medieval for a few weeks in a row. And it's hard to snap out of it, as my husband can testify. Listening to bizarre Latin sort of chanting on the you know, radio and so on. A little strange. But so I would sort of write, you know, maybe 2-3, you know, medieval chapters in a row, and then I'd go back to present day and write out that story. And then, of course, you get engrossed in that side of the story and so on. So that's a little bit about the writing process. And I got the idea in 2005 when I was in Siena, actually during the winter. So out of tourist season and just walked around and saw, sort of felt I was walking through the Middle Ages, and slowly started to figure out if this had legs, this story, and then started writing late 2005, certainly wrote through 2006 and 2007, and then very early 2008, I felt I had a good story. And that's when I went out and started trying to find an agent, which is a big process. And then once I got the agents all excited about it, we worked on the story for a few months over the summer of 2008 until we felt it was, you know, we'd edited sufficiently to go out and he auctioned it away. And it was Random House Ballantine that got the book, and I'm very happy about that. And since then, he's very, very sly, my agent. He knows all about these things. It's thank God, because I know nothing about this. So he said, let's try to put it out just before the Frankfurt Book Fair, because then, you know, there'll be a sale in the United States and the Europeans will pay attention. Right. And so they did. And at this point, I think 33 territories all in all have bought the book. So that means that, and because the book was delayed here in the United States, a few European countries actually already have the book out. So it's actually out in Germany, came out in April. It's out in Denmark. It's out in Holland. And it just was published in the UK 2 days ago. And apparently they love it already. So, well, who knows what are they telling me, but they're telling me the good news. But you know, we'll see how it goes. But obviously, this is what I'm most excited about. It's how are the American readers going to like this book? That's I'm very excited about that, and a lot, and very nervous actually, to be honest. And I think that I'll just stop freewheeling there and ask if you have questions. And please ask some questions. Yes.
What were you doing before this? Have you always been a writer?
What? And I'm just going to repeat your question because of the podcast. What was I doing before this, and have I always been a writer? Good question. I have probably always been a writer. I think, in the sense that I always would write stories. And I know, because I actually wrote a date on it, I know that I was 11 years old when I first set out to write a novel. And it was handwritten, and it's embarrassing. But my mom, unfortunately, my mom has all these things in a stack in her home. And sometimes when I'm home, I sort of look at it and, oh, you know, I said, Mom, please never show this to anybody. So I'm sure we all dabble in writing it, you know, and you know what I'm talking about. So before this, I have taught at a number of universities, been lecturing in Europe and here, and because I'm an historian of ideas, they can't really figure out where I belong. Am I in the history department? Am I in the literature department? And so on. But I think my most enjoyable course was creative writing. I love creative writing, but I've also taught European history, and to very excited some history majors and so on. So, I've worked in Washington, D.C. At something called Institute for Humane Studies, where we give out scholarships and grants to students, to young academics, and so on. So that's what I was doing lately. And then when the book was sold, I thought, why don't I try to make, you know, my dream come real here and just become a full-time writer? And now with a little baby, it's a little bit of a challenge, as I'm sure a lot of you know. It's a challenge to be anything but just full-time mom. I'm certainly working on another book whenever I get a chance. So hopefully my dream has come true. Any other questions? Yeah.
Should I assume that your first language is Danish?
Yes.
Did you write the book in English or in Danish?
Yeah, the question is my first language English or Danish, and which language did I write the book in? It's true, my first language is Danish, but I wrote this book in U.S. English. So I guess the follow-up question would be, you know, write a book in another language. But since moving to the U.S., English became my language. It's I function in English now, and it's Shakespeare's language. Maybe not U.S. English, but you know what I mean. It's Shakespeare's language, and I wanted to make fun. I wanted to do a lot of fun with Shakespeare in this book. And those, I mean, hopefully, I mean, Lisa, I hope you thought that there was. Okay, there's puns on Shakespeare. Okay, great. And that's just impossible in another language. I mean, you can't really translate Shakespeare, can you? Yeah.
What's your favorite Shakespeare play?
Oh, good question. What's my favorite Shakespeare play? I would probably, if I wasn't Danish, I would say Hamlet. But I've heard these something's rotten in Denmark, and it's your book. No, I'm just joking. Nobody said that, okay? But I heard that too often, being Danish. I honestly think it's Julius Caesar. And that's probably because I did specialize in the Latin, in Roman antiquity, during my studies. And I just love it. They're so memorable. And my husband knows that hardly a week goes by without me, you know, saluting him, you know, friends, Romans, husband, you know, where are you? And so, you know, it's just so ripe for punning. It's ripe for punning. It would have been better if I'd said Romeo and Juliet. But you know, as I said, I that's the problem about Romeo and Juliet. And if some of you are thinking, I don't really like Romeo and Juliet, don't let that stop you, though. Because as you'll find out in the book, Romeo, present-day Romeo, doesn't like Shakespeare's play either. And you got to read the book to find out why he doesn't like it. But those of us who've read or have Romeo and Juliet sort of fresh in our minds knows that it's not exactly as if Romeo has a stellar performance in this play, right? It's kind of Juliet. Juliet is running away with the show. He's, what is he, fishified, right? Mercutio says, why art thou fishified? Right, that's not really sort of hero material, is it? Being fishified, anyway. And of course, I pun on that in the book too, because Romeo sits with an old fish, you know. Anyway, never mind. Anyway, yeah.
Are you prepared to read a little snippet from the book?
Am I prepared to read a snippet from the book? I mean, do you guys have the patience for that?
Oh, yeah.
Do you want to hear something? Okay. That's okay. I'll try to. I read a little passage in Germany, actually. In the English, they wanted to hear the real version, so I read it to people in American English. And they loved it. And that was actually the balcony scene. So I'll just give you a tiny bit of the balcony scene. Let's just see here. 1 second here. It would be very embarrassing if I couldn't find it, right? You think she didn't write that, did she? This book. Okay, there we go. Okay. Okay, so let me just set the scene quickly here, okay? We've met Romeo and Julieta. This is the medieval part, the 1340 story. And I won't tell you how they meet, because that has to be a bit of a surprise. But Romeo now has gone out in search of her. And this is, you know, from Romeo and Juliet, the tragedy, that they basically crashed the party, right? Mercutio and Romeo and his lusty friends, you know, lusty gentlemen, they crashed the party at the Capulets, and that's when he, you know, sees Juliet for the first time. And here Romeo has been dancing and dancing and dancing and dancing, trying to, you know, see Juliet, because he knows she's there in the house, but she's nowhere to be found. Let's see here. I'm almost there, I promise. Okay, so he's going up there, and there he is. Okay, so he finally finds her up on this sort of a portico overlooking, it's sort of like a balcony, overlooking the dancing floor where everybody else is dancing. And she's just experienced a personal tragedy, which is why, you know, which is part of how she ended up in Siena. And so the girl, this is Julieta, is the girl. This is just Julieta and Romeo. And she looks at him. Just then, as he was turning to leave, the door at the end of the loggia opened and a slender figure, hair ablaze, slipped through the doorway like an ancient dryad through a crack in time before it closed again with a hollow thud. For a moment, there was no movement and no sound save the music downstairs. Yet Romeo thought he could sense someone breathing, someone who had been startled to see him standing there, looming in the shadows, and who was now struggling to catch her breath. Perhaps he should have spoken a word of comfort, but his excitement was too great to be harnessed with good manners. Rather than offering an apology for his intrusion, or even better, the name of the intruder himself, he merely tore off his carnival mask and stepped forward eagerly to draw her from the shade and finally unveil her living face. She neither engaged him nor shrank away. Instead, she walked over to the edge of the balcony and looked down at the dancers. Encouraged, Romeo followed her, and when she leaned over the balustrade, he had the satisfaction of seeing her profile glowing with the lights from below. While Maestro Ambrogio might have exaggerated the lofty lines of her beauty, he had not done justice to the luminosity of her eyes, because he painted her, okay, or the mystery of her smile, and the ripe softness of her breathing lips certainly he had left for Romeo to discover for himself. "Surely this must be the famous court," the girl now began, "of the King of Cowards." Surprised by the bitterness of her voice, Romeo did not know what to answer. "Who else," she went on, still not turning, "would spend the night feeding grapes to an effigy while murderers parade around town bragging about their exploits? And what decent man could contemplate a party such as this when his own brother has been?" She could not continue. "Most people," said Romeo, his voice a stranger even to himself, "call Messer Tolomei a brave man." "Then most people," replied she, "are wrong. And you, Signora, are wasting your time. I will not dance tonight, my heart is too heavy. So go back to my aunt and feast on her caresses. You will receive none from me." "I am not here," said Romeo, stepping boldly closer, "as a dancer. I am here because I cannot stay away. Will you not look at me?" She paused, forcing herself not to move. "Why should I look at you? Is your soul that inferior to your body?" "I did not know my soul," said Romeo, lowering his voice, "until I saw its reflection in your eyes."
She did not reply right away, but when she did, her voice was sharp enough to graze his courage. "And when did you thus deflower my eyes with your own image? You, to me, are merely the distant form of an excellent dancer. What demon stole my eyes and gave them to you?" "Sleep," Romeo said, gazing at her profile and hoping for a return of her smile, "was the culprit. He took them from your bed pillow and brought them to me. Oh, the sweet torment of that dream." "Sleep," the girl retorted, her head still stubbornly turned, "is the father of lies, but the mother of hope." "Perhaps, but the firstborn of hope is tragedy." "You speak with such familiar fondness, as one does only of relatives." "Oh no," she exclaimed, her voice shrill with bitterness, "I dare not brag of such high connections. When I am dead, were I to die in a grand religious manner, let the scholars argue over my bloodline." "I care not for your bloodline," Romeo said, boldly touching a finger to her neck, "save to trace its secret writing on your skin." For a moment, his touch made her silent, and when she next spoke, her breathless words rendered void the intended dismissal. "Then I fear," she said over her shoulder, "that you will be disappointed, for my skin spells no pretty narrative, but a tale of slaughter and revenge." That's it.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.